Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinsel. Every year, the Annie E. Casey Foundation issues a report that looks at the well-being of children all across the country. It's done on a state-by-state basis. It's called the Kids Count Report. The report measures 16 different categories in the areas of the economy, education, health, and family and community. Now, over the years, Vermont has done well on the Kids Count survey. In 2011, Vermont ranked fourth overall. In 2012, it improved to third on the list, and in 2013, Vermont rose to second. The 2014 report finds that Vermont is holding on to that second spot. So what are some of the indicators where Vermont is doing well? And in what areas could the state make some improvements? These are some of the questions we have for our guest today, Sarah Teal, who is a research associate for Voices for Vermont's Children, and Marianne Miller, Head Start Director for Capstone Community Action Council. That's the group formerly known as the Central Vermont Community Action Council. Welcome to Vermont Edition. It's great to have you here.
Thank you, Bob.
And if you'd like to join the conversation at Vermont Edition, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. What are your thoughts about the well-being of children in Vermont? What areas, what factors are the most important? Where do you think the state needs to improve? Are there some limits to what state government can do to improve the well-being of children? And what role does poverty play in the well-being of children in the state? Can it actually be linked to a lot of issues affecting children? 1-800-639-2211 is our phone number. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. Better still, give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. Sir, as I mentioned, the Kids Count Report, there are four general categories and four indicators within each category. But before we look at the specific data affecting the state of Vermont, give us your thoughts about the value of this kind of survey. Does it help identify trends at the state level? Does it include good measuring factors? What are your thoughts about the survey overall?
Okay, well, Casey, as a foundation, has been working with this Kids Count initiative for 25 years. This is their 25th anniversary sort of special edition. And their goal with the survey all along has been to make sure that everyone understands that tracking these indicators and tracking how well we're doing as a society in terms of creating a context in which our children can thrive is as important as tracking our economic indicators and the things you hear about on a daily basis, you know, how well the stock market is doing, what the unemployment rate is. But how well we're doing in supporting our kids is just as important as that.
And are you able to see certain trends if you look back at the last 10 or 15 years of the report? Does it help you follow certain trends in the state as well?
Yes, absolutely. They choose indicators that can be tracked consistently in every state and nationwide and over time. And so that's a lot of the reason behind why these are the particular 16 indicators. We may have others that here in Vermont we also like to talk about, but there's not comparable data necessarily between different states.
Marianne, what do you think the value of this survey is?
I think it informs certainly practitioners as well as policymakers. I am always, you know, interested to read it to see how well Vermont is stacking up against the rest of the country.
And as you look at that, is it tough to compare Vermont to other states? Do we compare it to other small states, other big states? Sarah, are there some areas where we can actually say, yeah, these are good areas of comparison?
Oh, sure. I mean, part of what they do is report things as percentages, and that sort of corrects for the fact that we're a teeny tiny state. But if you looked at something like children without health insurance, you know, clearly we have done very, very well with that because of Dr. Dinosaur. You know, that puts us way at the top, and that's a big factor. And so I think that there are some things where we really have to be careful about our small numbers. Percentages can change very, very quickly with, you know, a shift in one direction or the other. And so it's all about understanding the
And Marianne, as you look at this just from a general sense, and you say you always like to look at the mm-hmm. results and see how Vermont is doing. As you looked at this year's report, mm-hmm. were there a couple of things that kind of jumped out at you?
Absolutely. I mean, the first is that Vermont has 7,000 children who are not enrolled in pre-K education. And I think that's an enormous number for a small state.
And to put that in perspective, that's about half.
More than half. I mean, the good news is 49% of our children are getting some pre-K education. However, for children that are in public school early education programs, that may mean only 10 hours a week. And, you know, research indicates that children need more than that. You know, and we certainly have all the information about brain development and early childhood that tells us how critically important a period of time this is in a child's life. So I think that's an area we really desperately need to improve on.
And Sarah, what jumped out for you?
Well, just along the same lines, when we look at children who haven't been attending preschool, a lot of times it's been a financial consideration. And now that we will have 10 hours a week of public pre-K available to all children, we can maybe expect this percentage to improve. But at the same time, we have to recognize that a 10-hour a week schedule doesn't necessarily fit with anyone's work schedule. And so we need to make sure that lower-income families are able to access it to the same degree that higher-income families are.
Let's go to our callers and talk to Maurice, who is calling from Washington County. Hi, Maurice. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. How is everyone today?
Just great. What's on your mind?
Well, I just find it very hard to accept the fact that Vermont is number two in care of our children when I see that, 40% of the children get aid for food at schools. And during the summer months, there's so many that don't even get any 3 square meals a day. And yes, it's difficult to send to a preschool when you don't have enough income to take care of paying for that preschool. And that's the same reason why can't afford to feed their children, is that the economy here, I find very difficult for someone to raise a family on.
So, Maurice, just to differentiate, to make sure I understand the statistic that you're using, are you saying that about 40% of all kids in the public school system qualify for the federal breakfast or school lunch program? Is that the statistic you're looking at?
Yes, I am. And then look at those poor people, those poor children that during the summer months, they may not have a caretaker that can take them to go get free meals. And so they do without. Mm-hmm. And it all revolves around what their parents or parent can earn for a living and what they can afford to supply for their child. And it's a very difficult place to raise a child.
All right, Maurice. Sarah?
I really appreciate that comment, and I would like to speak to that. 15% of kids under the age of 18 are in poverty. That's 19,000 kids. We know that the range of poverty across all the counties in Vermont is from 10% in Washington County to 26% in Essex County, which is very, very high. We're still fourth lowest in the nation for child poverty, but that is an incredibly high number of kids. And just to put that in perspective, the poverty threshold, which is what this is talking about, this is kids below the poverty threshold, for a family of four is just over $23,000. Now, the cost, if you are a family of four anywhere in Vermont, to pay for all your expenses and be able to afford what's described as a secure but modest life, which is what we want for all of our children and families, you will be paying as a family of four without any assistance over $70,000. Now, if you're a single parent with one child, you'll be paying over $50,000 anywhere in Vermont. This is without any form of assistance. Now, there aren't that many $50,000 a year jobs to go around.
And if we look at the report, you know, we were talking about education, and there's some positive things there. Mm-hmm. Certainly in healthcare, there are things there. Dr. Dinosaur probably had a lot to do with that. If we look at economic well-being, we start to see a slightly different picture, Sarah, as you were just talking about. The number of children in poverty, 15%, this really has not changed in a number of years. And there's some people who might be looking at the state economy now or the national economy and thinking, well, there was the Great Recession and supposedly we're in this recovery period. But for some folks, that recovery just simply hasn't happened.
That's right. It hasn't happened yet and in Vermont or in any other state, really. Other states may have a much higher rate, but that doesn't mean that we can disregard our 19,000 kids in poverty and say, well, at least we're better than everybody else.
And the incidence of poverty is higher among families with very young children, 23%, I believe.
You know, if we look, if we stay in this sort of economic category, children whose parents lack secure employment, 28%, mm-hmm. again, unchanged over the last decade. That's, you know, that's sneaking up on a third of all children in Vermont are in households where the parents lack secure employment. Sarah, that's a big number.
It is. It's 35,000 children, and part of the reason for that is that it's very difficult to have a job and a child at the same time when you don't have any flexibility with your work schedule. You know, when you have to decide between going to work and not going to work because you might spend all of that income on paying for childcare.
And you touched on this in terms of housing. Children living in households that really have high housing costs. I think it's recommended that your housing costs be, what, about 30% of your overall income?
Right.
And in this case, we find that there are 36% of all children in Vermont who are living in situations where the housing burdens are significantly more than that. Marianne, that makes a big difference, too.
It absolutely makes a big difference. And a lot of our housing stock is old. The cost of heating in Vermont was a big issue last winter. First, we had a really, really cold winter. And second, we were feeling the impact of the federal sequestration. So there were cuts to the fuel assistance program. There were cuts, you know, to LIHEAP. And I know families in my program had a lot of anxiety, a lot of worry, a lot of insecurity about how they were going to even be able to heat their homes during the winter.
And if that's a major question, then mm-hmm. that really takes precedent over a lot of other things.
It does. I mean, do you pay the rent or do you buy fuel? You know, what do you buy for groceries? How well can you feed your family?
Today in the program, we're looking at the annual report, the Kids Count Report. It's issued by the Annie E. Casey Foundation. Vermont ranks second in the country when you consider all these different categories, four categories, economic well-being, education, health, family, and community. And what we're finding is in the area of health and education, things look pretty good in Vermont. The economic well-being is a little bit different, as we've been discussing. What are your thoughts about this subject? You can join the conversation by giving us a call at 1-800-639-2211. Send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net or give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. Sarah, we did get this email from Dennis who wants to know if child obesity is factored into the Kids Count report and what it shows if it is.
It's not, but I will say that obesity is actually linked with hunger. And if anyone is interested, Hunger Free Vermont has a lot of good information about this. But hunger is also a significant problem in Vermont and food insecurity.
Now, Marianne, you're the Head Start director over at Capstone. Mm-hmm. You've done this for a number of years. Has this program changed over the last decade or two? And if so, how has it changed?
I would say that Head Start has gotten better over the last decade. We are, you know, better able to measure our child outcomes and to individualize for each child, to support them to, you know, our best capacity. We are better able to train teachers and to actually look at the quality of the interaction between teachers and children. One of the things that Head Start does, and it continues to be a great strength of Head Start, is parent engagement. And we continue to bring parents into our classroom and to work with parents so that they can support their child's school readiness as well.
So, you know, there's some critics of Head Start, right, who will say, okay, you do all that good stuff. But as we follow these kids, and they're in the second grade, and they're in the third grade, and they're in the fourth grade, all these benefits that you talk about seem to disappear.
Well, I think that that study has been refuted many times. I mean, Head Start gives kids who would otherwise not have a Head Start a Head Start, and brings them into kindergarten on a level playing field with more advantaged children. We're unfortunately not there to support them through kindergarten, first and second and third grade, though it always amuses me that we're held responsible for that. James Heckman, Nobel laureate economist at the University of Chicago, has written and researched on this issue extensively, and says that, you know, the gains that children make in Head Start are in fact lifelong and significant in the quality of children's lives. I guess the other piece I'd like to add, Bob, quickly, is over that same decade, I have seen the problems that families face increase in complexity.
And that makes their lives much more difficult.
And that makes their lives much more difficult.
Sarah?
I would love to add to that that there has been a lot of really important work done in Vermont in past years to make everybody understand how important early childhood is in terms of a child's brain development and other development. But there are also periods of time that have been demonstrated to be similarly important. Adolescence is one, when brain development is also in a really significant phase. And what will happen eventually when people study this more and more is they will realize that there's never a time that's not important, and that children are never unaffected by what's happening to them. They cannot come through stresses in their life, hunger, poverty, traumas, without being damaged by that.
Let's go back to our listeners and talk to Nicholas in Glover. Hi, Nicholas.
Hello. There's so much to be said on this subject that in a short period of time, I'm going to try to be a little simplistic. I'm shocked that there's a study that says that children in Vermont are number two in the country in terms of well-being. My experience is coming from a county which is traditionally has the highest unemployment, the lowest per capita income, as many as, and most of the time, 50% or more of the young people have broken the law, come in contact with the so-called system, are under supervision by the system, they're on probation, or they were on probation. They can only find minimal income jobs. We're dealing with a system which operates in a series of silos. If you have a child who gets into difficulty in kindergarten, instead of realizing that this child, if not well counseled and tended to, is going to get into a lot of trouble by the time they're a teenager, and then when they do get in trouble, our response is to expel them from the school, and we plunk them right out into the drug culture in the community, and we wait for them to get in trouble doing petty thievery to support their habit, and then what we do for the next 20 years is punish them. If they go to the correctional institute, there's no treatment, there's no jobs, there's no counseling, there's no support of any kind. If they act out, they put them into solitary confinement. And so I'm very pessimistic until this state realizes that these problems begin in preschool and we have communication all the way along the way. And when a child really begins to get in trouble, instead of rejecting them, we put them into programs that are supportive and follow them until they are adults and can function properly.
Okay, Nicholas, we really appreciate your phone call. Marianne, what do you think of that?
I am so relieved to hear Nicholas's perspective, because the thing that I worry about when I read the headline, you know, Vermont number two, is that people will think that everything's okay, and it's not. We have made progress, you know, no two ways about that, but you know, we should truly leave no child behind.
And if we have made progress, instead of ceasing to do those things that have worked, we should continue to do them.
Yes.
Today in the program, we are looking at the results of the Kids Count surveys compiled every year by the Annie E. Casey Foundation. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. We're looking at the results of the Kids Count Report compiled every year by the Annie E. Casey Foundation. With us today, Mary Ann Miller. She's the Head Start Director for Capstone Community Action Council. And also Sarah Teal, who is a Research Associate for Voices for Vermont's Children. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. Let's turn to John in Richmond. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
My question has to do with a long-term approach. A lot of what's being discussed today is dealing with the immediate need, which is commendable and appropriate. The only problem is it's kind of like fighting a fire while somebody keeps adding fuel at the other end. Are we taking any steps, coordinated, individually, state, whatever, to address I haven't heard about the parents' involvement. You know, it's the parents' involvement in addressing, getting out of poverty. How are we using the educational system to prepare future parents to have the skills to have a job that they can raise a family? I mean, It's commendable that we're dealing with the problem at hand, but it only seems to be half the problem. And I don't see a change without a change in emphasis.
Okay, John, let's break John's question really into two parts. Sarah, I'd start with you. Long-term approach, John says, is needed. Are there some areas where you could say, yep, a long-term approach here is really needed, and this is what the state needs to make a priority?
Well, the problem is that the level of support that we give families and children is piecemeal and inadequate. If we were to adequately support all our children so that they could grow up without experiencing hunger, always safe, always supported, feeling valued by their community, what we would have in the longer term, in 10 years, in 20 years, is an incredibly strong workforce. It's incredibly ready to be the kind of citizenry that he's talking about.
And Marianne, John also talked about the role of parents. And don't we have just numerous studies that say that it's not the biggest factor necessarily, but it's very important if you measure a child's success rate through the school system that parental involvement is a very significant factor?
Yes, parental. The more a parent is involved with their child's education, the better the child's outcomes will be. And again, like tons of research on that. One of the real strengths of the Head Start model is that it's not just about kids, it's about families. And we very actively engage families in all aspects of the program. And just as we individualize for children, we also talk to parents about what their hopes and needs are and help them make plans and advance toward meeting those.
And parental involvement, does it also circle us back around to this issue of poverty? If you have parents who are working two or three jobs, care about their kids, but might not have the same amount of time to put into that, is that a factor?
Of course it's a factor, but I think that programs need to go to where the parents are. Right, not demand that the parents come to them.
And so how would that work? Give me an example of that.
Okay. I have home-based services, and some of my home visitors are making evening and weekend visits with families because that's when the families are available. Can we do that with everyone? No. But to the best of our ability, we do that. And I see other early childhood programs trying also to engage the families. I wish this was a concept that we could support, export wholeheartedly into the public school system.
Let's turn to Kim in Waterbury. Hi, Kim. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Just briefly, I wanted to share with the people on your panel and the listeners that there is a new program that has just gotten funding to start a program in Vermont called Blessings in a Backpack. And Blessings in a Backpack is a national program, and it finds schools with high levels of free and reduced lunches, and backpacks are donated and filled with food, and then the children take the food home to supplement food that they have during the weekend. The backpacks are returned on Monday and then filled the following Friday. And the schools that have implemented this program throughout the country have shown decreased levels of absenteeism. They've shown improvement in test scores, and is a very successful program. And a friend just contacted me. She knew I was here in Vermont this summer and had told me that they had just gotten a grant to start and are actually looking for the right school to get the program started.
All right, Kim, thanks for sharing that story. Do either of you familiar with this program?
Yes, I am.
Yes.
Yeah. And so it makes sense to me that if something like that is demonstrably successful, that it should be institutionalized. It should be more a matter of policy that if when kids are fed, they do better, we should make sure that they are always fed all year round at all ages.
Let's turn to Karen in Rutland. Hi, Karen. What's on your mind today?
Well, I have a lot of experience in working in schools in Connecticut, especially in the inner city, and these are the same kinds of problems that we've had to deal with. I'm really concerned mostly with getting the information out about town officials, legislators, people that make decisions, people that review programs, et cetera. That part needs to be strengthened, it seems to me. We have a lot of volunteers and people writing grants and those kinds of things, and those are very important, but I believe there needs to be, you know, a commitment, a bigger commitment by the legislature in our state to do all they can to find out, you know, search other states' programs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that should be the top priority, our kids.
All right, Karen, thanks for your phone call. We had someone, Marianne, who wrote in, and getting back to your question, you said, people are going to look at this and say Vermont is number two. Wow, we don't really have to do anything anymore because we've got all the answers to everything. And your opinion was quite different than that. Someone wrote us in and said, boy, if we're number two and we have the problems that we have, what does it say about our nation as a whole?
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, unfortunately, that is true, and that's why the United States ranks somewhere in the 60s for child well-being, you know, compared to the rest of the world.
And we have heard a greater number of people on the food stamp program, certainly more people on the school breakfast and lunch program. Is part of this an expansion of eligibility?
There is an expansion of eligibility with the free and reduced lunch program in schools. So schools that have a high rate of poverty in their service area are able to extend meals to all the children in the schools. You have to remember, it's also very difficult to be the only kid who's, you know, handing in a voucher.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Krista in Berkshire. Hi, Krista. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I have been at the school in Berkshire now for about 27 years. And I work with first graders, second graders, third graders, fourth graders, even with fifth graders. And I have seen the change in children over the years. And I think what we need to go back to is we need to ensure for a father or a mother to make a fair salary so that one part of the parental power can stay home to raise the children. Some of those children are hurting emotionally so badly that the only time sometimes you can help them is to hug them.
Krista, when you said you have seen the change over the years, can you describe that change for us briefly?
Children used to have self-confidence. They came in and they knew who they were. And that is because the parents taught them who they were. And they taught them the manners. But they're lost now. They're totally lost. Just this past, when the last day of school and when I left, and some of the children, they hugged me like they and they had tears in their eyes, and they would not let go of me. And the sadness in those children's faces, and I see the difference between parents that are there. Well, one of the parents is home, and it doesn't have to be the woman; it can be the husband. How wonderful this works out.
Krista, we appreciate your phone call very much. We're almost at the end of the program. I did want to ask both of you, you know, there's a year from now, we're going to have the 26th Kids Count survey coming out. Marianne, what factor or factors on the survey would you really like to see some improvement on?
Poverty. It really is at the root of so many of our ills.
And are there some specific steps you think that would be helpful to achieve that goal?
Well, I think that my colleague Sarah has talked about families need to have adequate resources to raise their children. You know, families need to have decent housing. They need to have medical care. They need to be able to afford to buy the groceries. They, you know,
Sarah, if we had you back a year from now, which I hope we do, what factor would you like to say to us? You know what? I was really hoping this one would improve, and look at that. It did. What would it be?
It'd be poverty for me, too. And if we could move 3,000 children out of poverty, that would move us to number one for what that's worth. As we've discussed, it's all relative. But that would make our poverty rate lowest in the nation, our child poverty rate.
Yeah.
Let's move them all out of poverty.
That's right. Children should have what they need. It's that simple.
Well, a year from now, I hope the two of you will come back on the program and we can see what the rankings are and see if there have been some improvements in some of these indicators. Sarah Teal and Marianne Miller, many thanks for being on the program today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for inviting us.
Coming up next, I'll talk to Bo Kilmer, a senior researcher at the RAND Corporation, about his work to outline the many factors that need to be considered in the debate over the legalization of marijuana in Vermont. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. There's a good possibility that the 2015 legislature will be asked to consider a bill that will legalize marijuana in Vermont. Lawmakers have called for a comprehensive study of this issue, and that work is going to be done by the RAND Corporation. Bo Kilmer is a senior policy researcher at RAND. He's also the co-director of the RAND Drug Policy Research Center, and he'll be the lead person coordinating this study, and he joins us now to talk about this effort. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
So some people might be wondering just at the start, why is the RAND Corporation interested in this issue?
Well, RAND's been around for about 65 years. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization, and the mission really is to improve policy and decision-making through research and analysis. 25 years ago, RAND created the Drug Policy Research Center, which I now co-direct, and we work on a variety of issues related to substance use and drug policy. But for the past 5 to 6 years, we've done a fair amount of work in the realm of marijuana legalization. That's when, in 2009, 2010, that's when the conversation started to get pretty serious in California. So we started doing some research there, and we've continued to kind of work in this area throughout the last 5-6 years.
So two states so far, Colorado and Washington, have decided to legalize marijuana. Some other states are looking at decriminalization. In your mind, is there a big difference between legalization and decriminalization?
There's a very big difference. In general, when people talk about decriminalization, they're usually referring to just reducing the penalties for possession for small amounts. You know, for example, having to go from being a misdemeanor down to something like a traffic citation. When people talk about decriminalization, it usually has nothing to do with production. When we talk about legalization, that's when we begin talking about not only legalizing possession, but also the production and distribution. And so what you see in Colorado and Washington is that they're allowing for-profit companies to come in and begin producing and processing the marijuana. So that's very different from just decriminalization.
You've done a lot of research on this topic. In one of the articles that you wrote, you raised the question of what can states learn from their regulation of alcohol and tobacco? What can they learn from that as they look at the possibility of legalizing marijuana?
There's actually a lot they can learn in terms of regulations, you know, if you're going to allow stores, information we have about days of operation, you know, operation times. I mean, there's kind of a lot of those details which can be learned. Two big ones to take away is you need to think seriously about taxation. Most public health experts believe that alcohol taxes are too low in the United States. And if you were to raise those taxes, you would actually end up with better public health outcomes. And so that's something that, you know, for jurisdictions that are thinking about doing something besides marijuana prohibition, they need to think seriously about how they're going to tax marijuana. There are a number of ways to do that. For example, you could tax it as a function of the weight, you know, for example, $50 per ounce. But if you were to do it that way, it creates incentives for people to produce more potent marijuana and purchase more potent marijuana. You could also tax it as a function of value, and that's kind of what they're doing in Colorado and Washington. But realize that, you know, if you see this big, a large decrease in the price over time, which we would expect, that's going to influence those outcomes. Another way of taxing would be taxing the marijuana as a function of its THC content. So there are dozens of cannabinoids in the cannabis plant. THC is the one that gets the most attention. That's what gets you high. That's what also increases the probability of anxiety and panic attacks. So one option, you could also, you know, tax the marijuana as a function of the amount of THC that's in there. So there are a lot of things you have to think about that. But taxes are important because they can only help shape some of the public health impacts, but obviously has implications for revenues as well.
So for someone to look at this issue and say, is it a yes or no? Should we legalize or not? If you go down the road to yes, it's not just a simple question. There are a lot of questions that get raised. The whole idea of for-profit. Now, Colorado and Washington have decided we're going to let businesses make money off this. In the state of Vermont, we have state liquor stores. So is that another possibility, another way to deal with the sale of marijuana?
Oh, yeah. If you're a jurisdiction and you're thinking about doing something other than prohibiting marijuana, you have a number of options. If you think about prohibition at one end of a spectrum, you can think about the commercial alcohol model as the other, as kind of the other extreme. And that's what we're seeing in Washington and Colorado. But there's a lot of policy space in between those extremes. Now, for example, a jurisdiction could maybe only allow home production or only allow collectives or co-ops. You can even imagine a model where you only allow nonprofits with a public health focus to be able to do the production and the distribution. And there's also another option is a state monopoly. There where the state's actually in control of production, it allows them to control the prices and allows them to limit marketing. But that option actually does not get a lot of it doesn't get a lot of play in the United States simply because we still have federal prohibition. States can't force their employees to violate federal law. So that's something you have to kind of keep in mind with all these reforms.
I'm glad you mentioned that. I mean, what is the impact of the federal government saying it's illegal to do this? And now we have two states who have legalized it. Vermont is looking at it. How do you factor in the role of the federal government into all of this?
Well, there's a lot of uncertainty. So, you know, when Washington and Colorado passed these initiatives in November of 2012, everyone was kind of waiting to see, well, what's the federal government going to do? And so everyone just kind of waited and waited and waited. And finally, it wasn't until August of 2013 that the Department of Justice released a memo and said that for the time being, that the federal government was not going to crack down on Washington and in Colorado, as long as they had strong enforcement and regulatory systems in place. I mean, it made it very clear that it wasn't – they weren't legalizing marijuana, but that for the time being, they weren't going to intervene. That memo also included some guidance to federal prosecutors to help them make decisions about whether or not to take a marijuana trafficking case. You know, I think there were 8 different guidelines. You know, for example, if it's a store, you know, distributing to minors, you know, you should go after them if they're serving as a front for organized crime. But it's important to realize that that memo – not only sent a signal to Washington and Colorado, it also sent a signal to other states and to other countries that at least for the time being, that the Obama administration was willing to tolerate, you know, potentially large for-profit companies to come in and produce marijuana as long as they play by their rules. Now, realize that federal policy can change within, but, you know, and also across administration. So when we have a new president in January of 2017, it'll be very interesting to see what decision they make about federal policy.
You were talking about taxation. If a state decides to tax the sale of marijuana and they apply too large a tax, does that have the impact of allowing an illegal market still to exist?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if the taxes are too high, you'll still have the black market there. And, you know, as you pay attention to what's happening in Washington and Colorado, I mean, Washington, they just started retail sales just a few weeks ago. It's going to be a long transition before they completely get rid of the black market there. It's going to take time. But you have to also keep in mind this issue with taxation and the prices. When you legalize marijuana, you really are going to reduce the production and distribution costs. Because right now when someone buys marijuana or they buy cocaine or methamphetamine, a lot of what they're doing is compensating the drug dealer and everyone else along the supply chain for the risk of arrest and risk of incarceration. That goes away with legalization. And then there's also potential for increasing economies of scale, changes in technology. So we would expect over time these production and distribution costs to go down. And so you need to think about that with respect to kind of doing projecting tax revenues.
So a lot of people are going to look at this issue and think that there's some pretty serious public health concerns involved. What would some of those be?
Obviously, there are people that end up becoming dependent on marijuana. It negatively affects them, affects their relationships. So there definitely will be people that will need treatment. You also need to think about their emergency room visits, you know, panic attacks. A big issue is driving under the influence. But, I mean, you got to kind of step back, though, and when we think about driving under the influence, you can't look at marijuana without also thinking about alcohol. In general, the research suggests that driving drunk tends to be worse than driving stoned, and driving stoned tends to be worse than driving sober. But one thing we do know is that when people are under the influence of both alcohol and marijuana, it really does increase the probability of a traffic accident. So those are things you kind of need to keep in mind. And kind of the other big public health issue out there is really trying to figure out how marijuana legalization is going to influence alcohol consumption. It's a big question mark. If you were to legalize marijuana and it does increase marijuana use, you know, is alcohol use going to go up or is it going to go down? Are they going to be economic complements, you know, and if they are, you really do have to kind of pay even closer attention to this issue of driving under the influence. However, if it turns out that they end up being substitutes, and so we have a lot of heavy drinkers moving from, you know, going from heavy drinking to becoming heavy marijuana consumers, that could actually be a net win for society. That's not to say that there aren't social costs associated with heavy marijuana use. There are. But they generally pale in comparisons to what we think about are the social costs associated with heavy alcohol use. I mean, you can overdose and die, traffic accidents, chronic disease, and violence. So, you know, as researchers, we're going to be paying really close attention to what happens in Washington in Colorado, not only to marijuana consumption, but also alcohol consumption.
So as you put this report together, do you anticipate that the conclusion might not be, yes, you should do this, or no, you should not do this, but here are the issues that you need to look at?
Yeah, I mean, we're still in the process of kind of developing what the table of contents is going to look like. But I can definitely tell you what's not going to be in the report. At the end of the report, you're not going to see a statement that says that Vermont should legalize marijuana. And you won't see a statement that says we think Vermont should not legalize marijuana. You know, we kind of see 3 different pieces to the report. The first being kind of an assessment of the marijuana landscape in Vermont, kind of helping people understand how much marijuana is being consumed. What are the criminal justice resources that are being dedicated to enforcing prohibition? Prohibition, kind of understanding what's happening right now. The second section is really going to kind of walk through some of the different options that the state of Vermont has, including doing nothing, and kind of thinking through some of the consequences associated with different policies, not just what they're doing in Washington and Colorado, but maybe some of these other models. So kind of thinking through those consequences. And then the final, probably the final section is going to draw upon some of the insights that we can learn from Washington and Colorado. Granted, I mean, with Washington only opening retail stores a couple weeks ago, you're not going to be able to do a full cost-benefit analysis. But that said, I mean, there are some insights that we can gain kind of as they've been dealing with the implementation issues that I think can be useful for jurisdictions that are thinking about these other policy options.
There certainly are a lot of different questions that need to be looked at in the coming months. Bo Kilmer is a senior policy researcher at the RAND Corporation, and he'll have a report for lawmakers to consider next January. Bo, many thanks for being on the program. I hope you'll come back in the fall to discuss this issue with us some more.
Bob, thanks for having me, and I look forward to coming back.
That is our show for today. Monday on the program, we'll look at the Back to the Land movement. The 1960s and 70s saw a lot of people arrive in Vermont because of it. Their idealism followed the legacies of Helen and Scott Nearing and Henry David Thoreau. We'll discuss the impulse to find meaning in a life close to nature. Send your questions or comments about the Back to the Land movement to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen Monday at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Sangari, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Catherine Hayes. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.